The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Prelude, the Storyteller. Imagine the windswept tundra, rocks and lichen and snow.
Let me tell you a story. See.
Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, and far, far away. Now, before we go any further, I think I need to explain something. I know that a lot of stories start once upon a time, a long, long time ago, and far, far away. And I think we should talk that through, because, you see...
My late 30s when I started out. One day I played with a hole puncher, kind of innocently and just playfully, and I punched holes into a stack of paper. And I looked at the holes and I thought of a bookworm. The first version of The Very Hungry Caterpillar was A Week with Willy the Worm. And it was just the way it is today, except the ending was different. Willy Worm grows into a big, fat worm. And then I showed it to my editor.
All right, this is a short portion of the beginning of chapter 2 of my novel, Sound. At this juncture, the narrator, since he has just spent the first night in his new apartment, he's woken up in the morning and he's going through his morning routine. I don't know quite when I started listening to music the way I did, incessantly and immersively, but I have a pretty good idea why. The music was space-filling. The voices were warming accompaniments for the wide, cold stretches of winter. The dulled, harsh edges and amplified warm tones like the late evening sun. I saw something even more in the hip-hop I first picked up years back on staticky radio broadcasts from New York. It added rough depths to glossy surfaces. Face to life's trouble. It seemed to fit a pattern. The songs I caught never let things extend indefinitely. They looped and repeated finite bars. Every few seconds brought you back to the same beginning before rocketing you out in a new, unexpected direction.
I didn't want to be topical. I think instead it just had something to do with this new mania for connections, my idea of integrity that meant you had to follow every thought as far as you could into all the sad dead ends. And to present this new way of thinking, I began to imagine new forms like pull-out sentences and multiple high-speed changes in direction. I imagined concertina pages of stories, pasted pictures, and why not? It wasn't that I wanted to make words visual like the former futuristi. I didn't believe like those marionetti that doing things to their look could increase the expressive power of words. But I was imagining a story that was made up of so many digressions and evasions that in order to make it readable, it would need to be divided in every direction.
Words, pictures, sounds, they're all starting to fly about. It's not only in the digital world that writers are breaking free of linear narrative. In the paper book, too, they're pushing text in every direction. New Jersey novelist T.M. Wolfe there. He layers thoughts, dialogue and description into a novel which looks more like a musical score, while Londoner Adam Thirlwell makes readers twirl, flip and unfold as he jumps out of his story with digression after digression. So when Richard Lee and I brought them together on a phone link across the Atlantic, we asked Adam first to describe his latest book, Kapow.
So Kapow is a mini experiment. It's not really a novel. I would describe it more as a novella at best. The kind of design aspect of it is that this is one of the most digressive things I think I've ever managed to write. And so some of the digressions suddenly zoom off in different directions or even to the main body of text. So at one point, I think there's a whole concertina of 9 pages where suddenly the thing kind of self-destructs. But the actual story itself is an unnamed narrator in London, I suppose sort of observing a revolution from afar, and it's definitely based on the Arab Spring, but deliberately not quite specific. So he kind of gets told stories about this faraway revolution by a slightly mad cab driver, mini cab driver. And then the story that he kind of finds out about is a love story, really, that's set during the revolution. So those are the various layers that I think are going on.
Yes, your narrator talks about how he wants scumbles and crossings out, like Cy Twombly. He says system where as many things as possible were visible at once.
Yeah, that was the idea, was that in some way, you would, rather than the normal story where kind of all kind of other possibilities are closed off, I wanted to have all of the kind of bits and pieces that normally you'd cut out, I wanted to try and include them.
And so, Tom, if you want to go next, maybe you could tell Adam and the rest of us a little bit about your novel Sound.
Sound is my debut novel, and it is written more or less like a musical score. So what that means is that the narrative is laid out with interspersed blocks of just straight up standard prose, and then the dialogue has tracks. So you can see what the different characters are saying to each other, but you can also see what the narrator is thinking while he's speaking to the people he's speaking to. And you can often see his thoughts down several layers, so you read the dialogue actually across the page rather than up and down.
Sound.
And then she turned to step onto the bus. I reached out across the space between us and pulled her close to me, close for a second kiss. She didn't resist. When I finally looked up, half the bus was looking on.
I'll see you around.
She squeezed my hand and stepped off, looking once over her shoulder.
Call me.
That night, I lay awake, replaying and remixing my time with her.
Call me.
She smiled like I meant something to her, like I could mean something to her.
So, call me?
She squeezed my hand and stepped off, like I did mean something to her.
So I had a really good time, and I'll see you around?
She smiled like...
Call me.
Looking once over her shoulder.
I'll see you around.
She squeezed my hand and stepped off. She smiled like...
I'll see you around.
Like I could mean something to her. Like I did mean something to her.
Call me.
Like I meant something to her.
Call me. Call me. Call me. Call me. Call me.
And what kind of universe are you conjuring up with it? Where are we?
It's set at the Jersey Shore, or a fictionalized version of the Jersey Shore, where I grew up. The main character in the book is also its narrator, Cincy. He drops out of grad school and returns home and takes up work in a boatyard that he worked when he was in high school, which has its own set of kind of colorful and interesting characters. And at some point early on in the book, he encounters a woman named Vera, and then from there, a love story of sorts develops. I also had this idea of sort of radical transparency where you could see everything that people were thinking and you could also see everything that they were hearing. The book explores that to an extent and also to a degree the kind of falsity that comes with that radical honesty. after a certain point you become so engaged in one character's mind that it's often difficult to see your way outside of it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, both of your narrators are in some sense thinking one thing, then the opposite of that opposite. You're pushing at the design to achieve some very different effects. For Adam, I think it's a kind of reflection of the divided, interlinked reality. And for you, Tom, it seems like it's a kind of novelistic polyphony, this kind of multi-voiced, this layered texture you were just talking about. But I was wondering, isn't it almost cheating to call sound a novel, Tom? Isn't a novel at bottom a story you can tell, a thing you can write down with a pencil and a piece of paper?
The book plays with this sort of tension as to whether it is a novel or whether what it actually is a record, and then what you're reading is just a transcript of an oral experience.
Ah, absolutely. You ducked out of reading a particular chunk I'd suggested for this podcast because you said it was built for you to perform via your sampler. But how are you envisaging that's going to go?
Yeah, I had an opportunity to test this out while I was out in California for the book launch in April. Basically, what I do ahead of time is that I have a makeshift recording studio of sorts in my bedroom, and I record snippets of the book, and then friends of mine will come in and record snippets of the book to do dialogue. I throw it all on a laptop, and then I hook the laptop up to an APC-20 digital sampler. Hmm. And what that allows me to do live is actually trigger all those samples and then reproduce the book in front of people through these different loops and sequences.
So, but doesn't that make sound not so much a novel as the score for a novel, like a kind of stripped down set of instructions for this kind of performance?
Yeah, I mean, you could also look at it as a score for a piece of music. Whole book can be performed and reproduced.
Like a symphony right there.
I'll see you around.
Like I could mean something to her. Like I did mean something to her.
Call me.
Like I meant something to her.
You can stop sleeping now. TM Wolf's sound is out.
Exactly. And Adam, your narrator talks of a story made up of so many digressions and evasions that it would need to be divided in every direction. But isn't making things whole, isn't making things fit together an unavoidable part of being a novelist?
I don't think it's a necessary consequence of being a novelist. I think that, you know, you can do probably far more than you often think. It's true that I think partly here I was not just playing with the form of the novel, but the form of the book. I think one of the things that a book does is it enforces a kind of certain chronology. And so this was a kind of way of thinking, well, what if you could actually make the book look different? Would that be a way of including things that you are normally forced to cut out?
Adam, it's almost like torpedoes of text have landed in the middle of pages at funny angles. And then you have these little glyphs.
Yeah, so basically the text was designed by Studio Frith, a London design studio. And they came up with various ideas. My basic idea was I wanted this very digressive text, and then their job was to find ways of kind of representing that graphically. And so what they hit on is that the ordinary flow of the text is interrupted by these little glyphs. I think they're like mini trees, basically, which was a symbol they invented.
They look like the beginning of a hangman's gibbet, don't they, that you
it's
play
a little
in that
bit
game,
sinister.
Hangman. You know when you're a child and you play that game,
no,
and you put the horizontal, the vertical, and then the horizontal.
They're the reader calling for help. Well, so they invented this this little kind of sign, which was the signal to the reader that that was when they should read these things, which are these blocks of text, which are sometimes completely upside down in relation to the rest of the text, sometimes kind of relatively just at a slight angle to it, or even bleeding out of the main text into a foldout. And the idea, the way I kind of constructed this was that you could follow every single digression, or you could just kind of keep going. And it was a kind of delicate thing trying to construct it so that occasionally I smuggled in real narrative into the digressions so that the reader wouldn't get too complacent and then just ignore them all. And then most of them, though, are kind of just extra thinking that I think normally if I were writing a novel, a story, I would have cut.
Isn't it just footnotes only inside the page rather than at the bottom of the page? I mean, people have used footnotes in that playful way, haven't
they? Yeah, and certainly someone like Nicholson Baker, like the mezzanine, you know, where sometimes the footnotes take over the entire page, was definitely an influence on the narrative style on all my books, I think. But I think the difference here, like when we were talking to the design studio, actually one of their first ideas was they showed me this wonderful book of photos by Robert Frank of Zero Mostel, the actor. And there's this beautiful little book called Zero Mostel Reads a Book, where he's photographed kind of, you know, trying to read a book upside down, trying to read a book kind of on the sofa, kind of holding the book far away at arm's length. And their idea was that they wanted the digression to be not just sort of, you know, intellectual, as it were, but physical. So they wanted to somehow move the reader. So the problem, so a footnote is just a kind of quick glance of the eye. So the idea of this was that you would physically have to be kind of doing something in order to get to the new text.
Because you do have to actually manipulate the book, Turn it around.
And in some cases, making it genuinely difficult to kind of actually, like, I think with the 9-page thing, it's really quite difficult to hold all at once. Like,
I was trying to read that on the train.
it's not a train book.
Now, we've also got in the studio someone whose opinion I'm very interested to hear about this, who is Lucienne Roberts, who has done something which is even more radical in a lot of ways, which is it's an experimental riff in book form on Dickens's Great Expectations. It's basically 70 different versions of the first chapter done by 70 different designers. Why on earth have you done this?
I'm co-founder of a publishing company called Graphic Design and we're looking at how graphic design connects with all sorts of different subjects. And the first subject that we wanted to choose was literature. And we decided in the end it would be more interesting to choose a text that in a way you sort of shouldn't do this to. So we went with the first page of Great Expectations, in part because, of course, it's his bicentenary this year, Dickens, but also because the text references lettering. So Pip is looking at gravestones and trying to work out from the lettering what his family might have been like. Of course, what it demonstrates, first of all, is, I mean, fantastic variety, the different approaches, the ways that some designers have been more respectful and others less respectful of the text. Going right from those who treated it more like a sort of conventional layout, if you like, but even those designers, the choice of font, the size of the margins, whether it was arranged left, all those things actually do have a bearing on how you read the text and what your expectation is, of course, when you first open the book. And others deconstructed the text completely. Some treated it more like an illustration. Others tried to evoke something of the atmosphere of the novel through the way they laid it out. But it demonstrates perfectly the difference that design makes.
Is this not just exactly what Lawrence Stern was doing all those years ago in Tristram Shandy? Tristram Shandy just keeps coming up for me.
Yeah, I mean, Tristram Shandy is obviously one of the great precursors of this. But
is he a precursor? Wasn't he it?
Well, no, because I think there are things going on in Tom's novel here that are kind of far more radical than, you know, it's true there are similar tiny effects in kind of Stern where he kind of tells you to shut the door or kind of, you know, that kind of, he certainly typographically, I think, is relatively sober, actually. It's true that he has kind of the black page and the kind of
mottled
page.
And the marbled.
Page. Yeah, so there are those.
And the missing chapter.
And the missing, Stern is my total love. I'm in no way attacking Stern, but I certainly think that there are further things you could do.
I'm kind of slightly wondering what it's like as a writer to engage with producing one of these book objects. Tom, I'm kind of fascinated. How did you put sound together? Did you have a notebook that kind of looks like this that you started drawing in? How did it work?
I was casting around basically for a form about 7 years ago to get at some things I wanted to say. And I had gone into a school supply store to get a notebook for a class, and I saw these composer's notebooks full of blank staff paper sitting by the register. They look cool, so I picked one up and then I started doodling in it, and from there the idea was sort of born.
And sort of doodling in all these different fonts as well.
The fonts are a late stage intervention in the book.
Is this a part of the negotiations between you and your designer?
Yeah, basically, when I submitted this is probably also, as a sidebar, instructions for what not to do when you're submitting a manuscript to a publisher. I submitted the manuscript of Sound to my publisher in Microsoft Word written in landscape. And instead of the different fonts, there were notations that I wrote in the left-hand margin to identify who was speaking or thinking, and then whether they were speaking or thinking in any given part. And then all of the bands in the book that are now gray-lined were in black boxes to show that they were all part of a group.
Wow.
It was very ugly. The designer who laid out the whole book, Jeff Clark, who works for a design firm called Quemadora in Michigan, he sat down and beautified the whole thing. And one of the things he introduced was this concept that instead of putting this sort of skeleton of notation in the margins, we would blend the notation directly into the text by assigning different fonts to the different characters and then also different fonts to the different elements that float through the book, like radio noise, and that we would also assign different fonts to indicate for the narrator whether he is reflecting on things in the past, thinking things in the present, or projecting things into the future.
So, Lucy, when something like that arrives in your desk, is that the kind of project that lights you up, or does that make you go, oh, my God, what am I going to do with this?
Oh, no, I mean, you know, I'm a typographer, and right from when I was a student, and I suddenly realised the difference that space makes, for example, which I think is very clearly demonstrated in both books, that, you know, space means pause, and what you can do with that, quite apart from what you can do with the scale of type or the boldness of it or whatever. It's rich, it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I mean, the question is always, of course, when it's appropriate and how much it supports the text or whether it actually destroys the text in a bad way.
Yeah, as in some of your page ones,
well, yeah,
the text is kind of thrown for Burton.
Yeah, I mean, there are, of course, issues around transparency, if you like, and how much typography should be transparent to allow the text to breathe and how much it shouldn't. But that's all down to the text itself. And there are also issues as to what you mean by transparent anyway, because, you know, we've got a couple of people in our book who've laid it out in a modernist way. So, you know, sans serif, range left, one size, one, you know. But that's hardly, given that it's Dickens, you could say that that's very high intervention because that screams, you know, contemporary.
I mean, some of these chapters you can't read at all. There's one that's laid out in columns.
The deconstructed ones.
The deconstructed ones. What's the point of that?
Yeah. I think, actually, what was interesting at our launch, one of the people who deconstructed the text in that way read that out. It was Morag Myerskoff, and she
it
became like a piece of concrete poetry.
So it goes chapter one, my father's family name being pirip.
Yes, but what was interesting was that one of the people at the launch was the the professor who we interviewed for our introduction, who's a Dickens expert, and he loved it because he thought that it made it very clear what Dickens used to place emphasis, you know, what language he used to play. And he found it really extraordinary and delightful and really intriguing.
Adam, you've got a certain amount of form when it comes to literary mischief, but did Kapow feel like stepping onto dangerous ground?
And what was nice here was the publisher and then the design studio. The design studio essentially, I think, co-wrote this book, that I slightly feel that their name should be on the cover. The entire form was almost dictated by them, down to word counts, that actually what they gave me was a template of word counts per page so that I would know how long a digression could be. Weirdly, although the whole point of this exactly was to be the kind of radical transparency that Tom's talking about, it was also under far more constraint than normally I would ever write. So to the extent that I think even one section with this 9-page pullout that we'd intended, so that was all fine. And then quite late on in the design process, we then realized that that would mean there'd be a 9-page blank kind of on the other side. And they didn't like that from a design. I was kind of happy with this, but they thought design-wise that looked kind of wrong. So they said, you need to write a kind of new thing. So I had to add a digression I had no intention of ever writing. And then what became hysterical was that like I was like 3 words over what they wanted. So they'd say, no, you have to cut kind of 3 words. And then like that was like really enjoyable, I think, actually, that there was a sort of way in which these extra almost chance kind of factors were coming into the composition.
Lucienne, does this make you feel very powerful?
No, I mean, first of all, hearing about that experience is very heartwarming because I think that's not the experience that lots of designers have. It's not such a collaborative process always. And it sounds mutually respectful, which I think is absolutely wonderful. And it shows actually what can be done when words, text are treated in parallel, if you like, and work together. That's what's so wonderful.
These are things that couldn't have been done 10 years ago.
I suppose from the point of view of your book, it's much easier to do it now, definitely. It could have been done, but it would have been a much more laborious process. You know, scalpel, cow gum, so on, would have been quite difficult, cutting and pasting and really...
I mean, isn't that a deep irony in that we've got, you know, we've got the book is under attack from technology, particularly digital technology all sides, but yet there are these new territories being opened up. Yeah. Do you think we're going to see more of this?
Yeah, I do. I mean, actually, I think what the book can do is being re-looked at, and that's what makes it so interesting. And that goes all the way through from a sort of print production point of view. That I think people are becoming much more sensitive to paper choices and colour use and all of those things, because in the end, that is what makes it different. I mean, this is a real designer thing, but, you know, you can't get a decent orange unless it's printed as a Pantone and it's, you know. So those things, you go, yes, we want, you know, fluorescent or whatever. So those things become foregrounded, of course, in terms of their potential. And actually, that's what makes books lovely. They are three-dimensional objects and the journey that you go on with them is entirely different.
Could you read them for stories? I want an answer from both of you. Could somebody pick up these two books and read them for the story they're in?
Yeah, I think definitely, totally, entirely.
I think so. I mean, it's that the story is told in a slightly different way from the way a lot of stories are told.
I know you didn't ask me, but I think that's, as a reader, that's certainly true. The experience of reading them is that you get a character and a story and, you know, the usual narrative kind of warmth.
So, I'm really interested in the fact that we haven't referenced film once in this conversation, because it strikes me that if we're talking about changes in the way our brains are wired to read stories, film is absolutely central to that, sort of flashbacks, flash forwards, all those sort of panning ins, panning outs.
Yeah,
we seem to be better at reading a grammar of kind of flash forwards and kind of going backwards in film far quicker than we seem to be kind of coping with in novels, I think.
I remember actually working on sound a few years ago and having difficulty figuring out how to communicate dashed expectations. I went to the movie theater and saw 500 Days of Summer, and there's a great scene in that movie where you're shown two narratives that are moving in parallel, and then one of the narratives is exposed as a fantasy and the other one is exposed as true, and it's sort of crushing when it happens. And from that, I said, oh, well, you know, I can go back and I can do this in a book. I can show the text spooling out an idea of how things are going to go, and then I can actually ram up how things are actually happening right up against that and try to develop a sort of energy from that.
Two writers and a designer there setting off on a journey of discovery set free by the modern, cut-up, multimedia world. T.M. Wolfe's Sound is published by Faber. Adam Thirlwell's Kapow is published by Visual Editions. And Page One, Great Expectations is published by Graphic Design And. Coming back the other way on a journey towards straight fiction is the artist Graham Rawle. He began as a cartoonist on The Guardian, where his Lost Consonants series ran for 15 years. The Diary of an Amateur Photographer was a murder mystery in pictures, while his next project, Woman's World, assembled a novel out of scraps of text cut from women's magazines. Only now, with The Card, has he arrived at something resembling straight fiction. He told our Richard Lee why.
There was always a visual element in the writing. The writing's become increasingly important part of what I do. And it could be argued that the visual element is less noticeable. But because I do have that kind of visual background, I find that I can add an extra layer to the narrative. So outside of the words, I can actually put things on the page that can give some kind of clue as to the protagonist's personality, the emotional content of the scene, the state of mind of the hero. And these are kind of subliminal or visual clues as to what's going on that not necessarily there in the text.
Is it also a sign of increasing confidence in the power of just straightforward story?
I think it's just really interesting that you know, with Woman's World, Norma uses scraps of found text from women's magazines from the early 1960s as a way of creating this perfect woman persona. There's a reason why she can't. I won't reveal why. But there's a reason why she can't live up to the expectations of the magazines. The kind of these very high idealistic standards that they set. So in order to kind of create this kind of ideal woman persona, she actually uses the physical words on the page.
Cuts them out and sticks them in.
Sticks them down so that what we hear of the voice is the voice of the women's magazine as spoken through this strange character's voice.
But I'm wondering if you're feeling a sense of more freedom for your writing now, if you've got more flexibility, if you're working more as a kind of prose writer than as an assembler of other people's poems.
Yeah, I think so. I'm fascinated by story. I'm fascinated by story structure, why stories work and why they don't work, how they're constructed. So I can see a time when there might not be any visuals. I might write a film script, in which case the visuals will take, you know, be created by somebody else. I'm really interested in telling stories, and I tell them in the best way that I can. Mm. And because I have such a strong visual background, it seems like a missed opportunity if I don't actually use something of that in order to introduce an extra element to the story. Because the thing is, it's more expensive. Every time I have an idea, it costs the publishers money. This Is Your Life occasionally had slightly awkward moments. If there were skeletons in the family cupboard, if there had been a suicide in the family, or if the show's star had been married before or was secretly homosexual, in which case the wife chair beside the star would invariably be occupied by the subject's mother, but Eamon would smooth over any biographical blemishes so as not to offend anyone concerned. It did make me wonder, though, how they'd handle my family situation. Who would they choose for the special surprise guest at the end of the show? No prizes for guessing that one. Eamon would make the announcement. Yes, he's taken time out of a busy recording schedule and flown over 4,000 miles from his home in Florida just to be here with you tonight. Your cousin and close personal friend, international singing star Barry Manilow. The screens would go back, and Barry would be there with his white teeth and wrinkle-free smile. We'd embrace and speak into each other's ears about how great it was to meet again, and pat one another on the back like men do. It would be a fitting finale. On the other hand, perhaps Eamon would opt for a non-celebrity, family-themed reunion in a bid to bring a more heart-rending climax to the show. In which case, Barry would only be the penultimate guest. There would be one final surprise in store. Barry would take a seat alongside my other celebrity chums, clearing the stage for Eamon's final revelation. I would adopt a quizzical look, pretending I had no idea what was coming. Well, Riley Richardson, this is your life, and your incredible story is almost complete. But there's one special person who you haven't seen tonight, one person without whom your life might have taken quite a different turn. He walked out on you and your family without warning one Sunday morning back in 1967, and you haven't heard from him since that day 30 years ago. So you naturally presumed he was dead. Well, Riley, he's not dead. He's very much alive, and he's here tonight to say hello. Yes, here he is, your long-lost father, Brian Pincus. There wouldn't be a dry eye in the house as Dad stepped out from behind the screens, overwhelmed with emotion. Of course, there would be some awkwardness, neither of us knowing quite what to say to each other. On my part, understandably, there would be questions and a great deal of resentment, but I'd have to suppress that for the sake of the show. I suppose the tearful embrace would say it all, that though there were unresolved issues, we were still father and son, and that strength of that bond would ultimately persuade me to let bygones be bygones. Then, at the after-show party, when the audience had gone home and the studio cameras had been packed away, I'd find a quiet moment alone with him so that I could punch his face in.
Graham Rawl's narrator sets off on his search for his missing father after finding a series of cards in the street. Richard asked him where exactly he picked the idea up.
Did you find it lying in the street?
Well, sort of. Yeah, I did, yeah. I read a story years ago about a man in Chicago who was walking down the street one day and found a playing card, picked it up. This is in the 1800s. Picked it up, a week later found another card, picked that one up, and wondered whether every time he was out he could find another card. Ultimately, he might get a whole deck of cards. And this he did. It took him 30 years. And I thought, this is extraordinary, because I'd never seen a playing card on the street. It just doesn't happen. But the very next day, outside my flat, on the pavement, there was a playing card.
A sign.
So I picked it up. It was a sign. So I picked it up. I've been collecting now for 20 years, and I've got about 30 cards. So I've got a long way to go. But also, I collected bubblegum cards as a kid. So I've always been a collector of cards. And cards sort of crop up in my work, in my visual work, because they represent something of my childhood, something about the childhood that's been lost, you know, that's been taken away.
So where did you get the idea of stringing an adventure story off these discoveries?
I thought it was a good narrative device to tell a story. Riley in the story is in search of one particular card, card 19, the rarest card of all from the Mission Impossible 1967 TV series.
The mythical card?
The mythical card. So rare that people doubt its very existence. So he's looking for this one card, and we realise that Riley is a bit of a strange bod, and that he makes connections where connections don't appear to be. He's in pursuit of this card, but we realise pretty soon in the story that the card actually represents his father, because his father disappeared at the same time that he was collecting the cards as a kid. So he's pursued the card unconsciously, actually, is his way of trying to locate his father, who ran off with the secretary when he was 10.
Yeah, Riley is so stiff, so judgmental, he's so self-important, so marvellously self-deluded. Where did the voice come from?
I suppose some of the voice is me, really. You know, somebody was talking about, you know, the strange connections that he makes, and I thought, well, I make those connections. Don't, you know, doesn't everyone spot that Barry Manilow and Bob Monkhouse have the same initials, and Bob Marley and Bobby Moore? And apparently they don't think that. So I think in terms of making connections, that's the way my mind works. And so it's very easy for me to see the world through Riley's eyes.
You're also writing into a piece of contemporary history, the death of Diana in 1997. Did the period come first and then you realised Diana was around, or was it the other way around? Did you need to write into that tragedy?
Well, of course, you know, it's because the book is set in 1997, we know that Riley decides that the cards are giving him a message, and the message is that he must rescue Princess Diana from grave and imminent danger. It's 1997 and 1967, so there's a very exact 30-year gap between the two kind of parallel stories. So the card that he lost when he was 10 is 1967, and 30 years later, he's still looking for it.
It is the late 90s with Tony Blair in Downing Street and Oasis playing on the stereo, but there's a powerful sense of nostalgia for the kind of vanished 60s. Do you yearn for the Britain of cigarette cards and sandwich spread yourself?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, all of my work is deeply rooted in, not so much because it's the 60s, because it's my childhood. I mean, I was 10 in 1965, so
picking up the cards
and
changing them in playground.
Yeah, and there's something about that pursuit of the personal history, the kind of childhood things. The cards, there were a set of cards that were taken away from me as a kid, the James Bond cards.
It still hurts.
It still hurts. They had pictures of scantily clad women in them, and my mother thought they were just disgusting and shouldn't be allowed. So they were put on the bonfire, and I was not allowed to have those cards. So in a funny way, they've become a handy metaphor for that part of my childhood that's been lost or that's been taken away from me.
It's gone up in smoke. The book's beautifully laid out with these full bleed images of these cards as he discovers them, and which you've specially designed for the book as well. You also had a lot of fun with the typography. There's also a handful of symbols which appear in the margins when various subjects like golf or keys or signatures come up. What's the idea of those?
Well, the idea is that because Riley makes connections all the time, I think to lay those into the narrative would have been probably annoying after a while. So they are a sort of, they're Riley's kind of shorthand code, really, that when he spots that Barry Manilow has the same initials as Bob Monkhouse, he'll make a note of that in the margin, and we don't have to read about that in his description.
After a while, the reader starts to spot them coming up in the text, so it's almost like picking up, discovering a card in the street, discovering a thing, and you know that's coming next.
Yeah, I think the idea with the book is that I'm trying to make people see the world through Riley's eyes. So I'm trying to get people to see the connections that he makes. So what appears to be kind of random data, a card lying on the ground, you just think, well, that's just a card. It's just there by chance. But when you find two cards and they're both the Queen of Hearts, surely that's got to mean something.
Yeah.
And if you start thinking like that, then you start thinking like Riley thinks.
Yes, indeed. Or indeed like Graham Rohr. It's one of the things that interests me as well is that at a time when everyone thinks the book is under threat from various digital kind of Amazon or from ebooks or all this thing, is this kind of book with these beautiful production values, with these extra elements, is this a future for the book that will give it something that you can never reproduce digitally?
I think there's something to be said for holding a book like that in your hand. It is an artifact, and lots of things that you couldn't do digitally appear in the book, and I make use of that. But having said that, converting the text into a kind of digital form, I start to look for what I can do with that, because that's, rather than make a sort of compromise or a kind of lesser version, we think, okay, what can the digital version do, and what can I do to manipulate it in order to tell my story in a more effective way?
So it's taking whatever's in front of you and making the most of it.
Yeah, seeing what the possibilities are. And I think, you know, at the moment what people are doing is making digital books sort of look like real books, you know, so we flick the page in the same way. But of course, you know, digital books can do much more in some ways or different things. And I think rather than see it as a compromise, I think is to explore its capabilities.
Yeah, what we need now is some artists.
That's right. We need some artists to think creatively about how to make digital books interesting.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.